262. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson recording this show from Christchurch, New Zealand on the South Island, Te Waipounamu. It's Thursday, the 17th of January, 2019. Today's show is a tribute in memory and in honor of my beautiful spiritual brother, Rob Alliston. Rob Alliston was and is a very, very, very dear friend of mine, a true Tasmanian who I had known since, well, we had been in touch since 2003. We never actually met in person until 2007. But anyway, before I get started, I'd really like to thank Jill Stanley at UCY-TV for her several years of very, very intensively dedicated service to creating an investigative journalism radio platform, UCY-TV, and for hosting my show and dozens of others. And she recently had a 3 or 4 month hiatus due to a few issues, but she's brought it back online a few weeks ago, and it's really cool to be back to doing my weekly radio show, getting back in the groove of doing my email posting every weekend. My new show each week now is live at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time in America. Rob Alliston was a truly legendary friend and Australian and Tasmanian. And the reason that I ever even knew about him, now this is an example of how freaky things that might initially seem bad could end up being one of the coolest things that ever happened because of the things that it sets in motion and the meetings it creates and influences of your decision making. But anyway, in 2001, I was hitchhiking in Tasmania and got a ride with this bloke. And anyway, this is a whole story in itself. I mean, I could tell a whole radio show about this singular event in my whole 400,000 kilometers of hitchhiking over about 30 years all over the USA and Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. This is the only time that somebody stole all my gear. They tricked me into getting out of the car in the middle of nowhere in Tasmania and sped off with all my gear, leaving me standing there. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, a week later, this dude had brought all my stuff back because he was scared, because some friends that I didn't even know I had paid him a visit. Well, anyway, I won't tell that story now, but I've written it up. It's called The Ghoulest and the Coolest, which is on my Synthesance blog. Because of the extra week that I spent in Tasmania, because of this event happening, there was about a week between when the dude stole all my stuff and then before I got it back. During this week of time is when I met several really cool people, and I met or was able to hang out with in greater detail my friend Louise Harrison, a Tasmanian woman now living in Byron Bay, who had spent a lot of time with Rob out on this legendary little island where he grew up and his family and his mother, Elizabeth Alliston, who wrote a very interesting book called My Life on an Island or something like that. But anyway, it's called Three Hummock Island. It's a member of the Hunter group of islands off the northwest coast of Tasmania, not all that far from Smithton. So anyway, during this time, during this extra week, I was hanging out in Medina and Hobart and hung out with Louise Harrison, and she told me about her time out there with Rob, and she really thought Rob and I, she thought we were like brothers, even though he and I hadn't met, and knew that we would really like to meet each other and become friends. So Rob and I kept in touch, and that was in 2001. In 2003, I was in Tasmania, and Rob and I were going to try to meet, and he was living on Three Hummock Island. And so what I did was I hitchhiked to Smithton, which is the furthest most northwestern town in Tasmania. I hitchhiked to Smithton because Rob was supposed to be flying in that day on a little private plane that his very close friend was the pilot. That's how they got back and forth from the island. Well, he was going to fly into Smithton, and we were going to hang out, go and have dinner or lunch or something like that. And maybe I think I was going to catch a ride to Hobart with him or something. Well, anyway, I was sitting there waiting for Rob's plane to come, and it didn't come, and it didn't come, and it didn't come. And it was hours late, and I was really worried. And finally, I rang Rob, or he rang me. No, well, yeah, I didn't have a mobile at this time, so I would have rung Rob. And what happened was the plane crashed, and his very close friend, the pilot, was killed because of a malfunction with the airplane or something. And this was when he was on his way from Smithton to Three Hammock Island to pick Rob up. So this was extraordinarily traumatic, but luckily it wasn't after he had picked Rob up and it crashed on the way back, and they both, or whoever else, would have been killed too. So this was the note on which we almost first met. So I spent the night in Smithton, hitchhiked back to Hobart the next day, and Rob and I kept in touch. And so then finally in 2007, I was in Hobart. I'd been doing some artwork for some friends of mine, and I went over and met with Rob and his partner, Elaine, at that time in Battery Point, which is kind of a high-end historical part of Hobart over near Salamanca Market. And we met and sat and talked for quite a few hours and really got to know each other and stuff. And he and Elaine loved my art, so on the spot, they commissioned me to do a really super nice painting, which is still, to this day, one of the coolest paintings I've ever done. It was sort of like about a 2-meter-long, full-size canvas of a very complex mandala based on my interpretation of what sound might look like to the whales and dolphins, because Rob was a very, very, very big supporter of the whales and dolphins and of me, and he was also a big supporter of Paul Watson and Sea Shepherd, but I tried to set him straight on that. But it was actually Rob's had a copy of Watson's autobiography that I've thumbed through and read and pulled out some very disturbing quotes out of that book. That's another story in itself, too. Anyway, Rob and I kept in touch. I went up to Darwin later that year. And in June of 2007 in Darwin is where I met this beautiful young Belgian girl named Lisbeth Verstraeten, who she and I spent a night together when we met, and we stayed together literally for the next 5 years. At this time, up in Darwin there, I was working on Rob's painting and several other paintings, and and I'd like to thank my friend Peter Chumley for having me there, and he's still probably the single greatest supporter of my art that I've ever had in my life. So anyway, that was 2007. Lisbeth and I hitchhiked down the west coast and across the Nullarbor, and we went to Tasmania the next year and actually stayed in Hobart and hung out with Rob a little bit. He was always very supportive of us. He would give us rides and help us find places to stay, and we weren't ever able to stay with him and Elaine very much because we kind of didn't really fit their kind of highfalutin vibe, especially Elaine. But Rob was very cool. But Rob, ever since I met him in person, I learned that he had Parkinson's disease. And he had it pretty severely. And he could get around and do stuff. But even in 2007, when I met him, he was doing all kinds of alternative therapies, like having electrodes on his feet and hands and all kinds of nutritional supplements and everything they could do within the alternative and allopathic mainstream medical tradition. And so we kept in touch, and Rob loved his painting. That was he got it in 2008. Then, let's see, the next time I saw him, I think actually I didn't actually see him again until 2013. When I came back from Hawaii, I went and stayed with Rob because now he was living in Sheffield, a town kind of inland from Devonport up on the north central part of Tasmania. But I'd also like to thank Rob for a connection he made for me the year before. He had also had a yurt and some property at a little remote community near Cradle Mountain called Lorena, a very progressive little community. And he invited me to go there and stay in his yurt and hooked me up with a ride with a friend of his to take me there. So I went there in Rob's absence, stayed at Lorena, met some really, really, really cool people. And then I went to Hawaii. And so then when I came back in 2014, I went and stayed with Rob in Sheffield. He was living in an apartment in kind of a little retirement village. And that was really cool. And we hung out and did a lot of stuff. That's when I interviewed him three times for my radio show, because he was a very multidisciplinary, talented person. He was very interested in the history and the affairs, current, past, present, and future of the indigenous people of Australia. And he was a very avid environmentalist. And he also loves the whales and dolphins. And so I interviewed him for my radio show three different times during this time. Well, and another thing happened. During this time, one evening I was in the living room getting ready to roll out my sleeping mat, and I heard a sound, a funny sound, and I turned around and looked and saw him picking himself up off the floor. And I go, like, Rob, are you okay? And he goes, like, well, yeah, I just fell down. So I figured he was all right. Well, anyway, a few hours later, I was asleep on the floor in the living room, and I heard him gasping and calling out, yelling to me from in his bedroom, Jeff, oh, I can't breathe. I'm in so much pain. Can you call the ambulance? Call the ambulance. And I go, like, oh, my God, what's wrong? So I called the ambulance, and they came and took him to the hospital. And what had happened was, he had fallen and hit his chest on the arm of the sofa. This is when my back was turned. I didn't see it happen. And what he had done was he refractured his sternum, you know, the main center bone in your chest, because unbeknownst to me, a few months before, he had had a car wreck in which he cracked his sternum. And that's when he had to quit driving. But he never told me about that. So this fall refractured the sternum. And so in the middle of the night, he couldn't breathe and was in all this pain and stuff. And he had to go to the hospital. So anyway, he was living by himself. And so instead of leaving soon as I had planned to do, to go to Sydney and then back to New Zealand, I stayed around for as long as it was going to take for Rob to get out of the hospital and come back and be settled into a normal life and make sure he was okay, because he didn't have anybody taking care of him or living with him or anything, and none of all his family live in Melbourne. Anyway, this is another story in itself. He was in and out of the hospital like about half a dozen times, and all different kind of weird stuff was happening. He would have a different doctor from one day to the next, and they were prescribing wrong medications, and just all these different kind of disasters were happening. And I was quite concerned about it all. But finally, it just was going on for so long that I had to leave because my visa was going to be up. I had to leave and go to Sydney and then back to New Zealand. And eventually he did get out of the hospital and he was okay. But it was like weeks. You know, so that in itself was a whole chapter. And I met all these people in Sheffield, and first was just like in like Flint. Thought it was the coolest place in Australia, and gave away several dozen painted rocks, and they invited me to do all these art projects and stuff. But then they all turned on me. Oh my God, I've never had a situation like that. And then I became demonized by everybody in that community because it's like quite gossipy and cliquey there. That's another story in itself, but it never really mattered. So anyway, that was 2014. So I didn't see Rob again until this past June of 2018. Or no, maybe I did see him a couple of years ago, but just briefly. I went and saw him at his room there in the nursing home. Anyway, June of 2018, I was in Sheffield. I was staying with my friends in Lorena. We had come to Sheffield for the day. And I went and stopped in and saw Rob just because I only had about an hour. And he was in great health. He could get around. He had to use a walker to walk, but he was mentally extremely sound and happy, and really happy to see me. And he was just getting a haircut. He was going to go around and visit some of the ladies in the ward and stuff like that. And we always really enjoyed each other's company and talked about and would share just completely. You know, we were on the same page with just about everything. And so anyway, we talked about all this stuff, and about I had to leave because my ride was going to leave. And right before I left, he said, Jeff, he got really serious, and he says, Jeff, there's something I want to share with you. And I go, well, Rob, what is it? And he goes, like, well, you know, sit back down. So I sat down, and he told me, okay, now he was living in kind of a aged care nursing home kind of facility that he had his own room, but there was like plenty of doctors and nurses and support people around all the time. So he told me that a few days before, he had overheard some of the doctors there talking about euthanasia. And not only were they just talking about euthanasia, Rob told me that they were talking about euthanizing him, i.e. killing him. And I go, like, Rob, you got to be kidding. You know, I thought he was joking. But no, but he was totally serious. So now I have to add as a footnote, I'm not that familiar with Parkinson's disease per se, but it is not neurological, or it doesn't affect how people think, like Alzheimer's does. But Parkinson's is purely metabolic or physiological, but it does not affect how people think or their perception of reality, their cognitive clarity. But all along, ever since I very first met Rob in person in 2007, because of his medical condition, I was always kind of looking to see if I saw even the slightest sign of any kind of dementia or cognitive degradation or anything like that. And I never once did. Au contraire. He was writing a book that he was working on full on, like the time I stayed with him there in Sheffield, and during this last meeting that we had, he was talking about all the different progress that he had made and everything. He was telling his story, which is a very interesting chapter in the history of Australia and Tasmania. So anyway, and as I was listening to him tell me about overhearing the doctors talking about euthanasia, I was scanning to see if I could detect any dementia at all, and I could not. I could not detect even the slightest hint of any kind of mental malfunction or degradation in his thought or reasoning or imagination or anything. He seemed as clear as a bell, as clear as ever, totally coherent and right there. And he was adamant that that's what he heard. And so I go, like, well, Rob, I believe you. And I go, like, but look, why would they want to do that to you? You know, you're not a troublemaker. You're a very good person, and good person to have here in the hospital. Everything's paid for. They got plenty of beds. There's extra rooms and stuff. What possible motivation would they have? And we couldn't figure it out, and I didn't have much. I had to leave hanging on that note, but it really made me think about a lot of things. And I think, I can't remember if I asked him, but I'm pretty sure, even whether Rob told me or not, but I'm pretty positive that I'm probably the only person that he shared that with, because there was really, he certainly couldn't mention that to any of the people there. Oh my God. But I don't think he probably told his family, because they were quite conservative and viewed him to be a bit eccentric anyway. They were all in Melbourne, and he had some pretty close friends there, but I don't know if they would have believed him or not, but I did. I took it to heart. And I really was worried, you know, I was concerned about everything. Anyway, this is setting the stage for what I'm about to tell you, because this was in June of 2018. All right, well, in November, 4 months later, I was in Rarotonga, and I got an email from Louise Harrison, our friend who originally introduced me to Rob back in 2003, telling me that Rob had died. And I went, oh my God, how weird is that? Because for 15 years, he had been in, to me, very stable, not really declining health. You know, maybe he was very slightly losing his mobility, and but he was improving. I mean, you know, right before I first went and stayed with him in 2014, he had just got back from doing some tramping by himself on Kangaroo Island. And he had also done the entire overland track there in central Tasmania by himself. That's a several day, pretty rugged walk. So he was doing all this stuff. So here he was in June. He seemed in perfect spirits and good health, and told me he had overheard doctors talking about euthanizing him. And then in November, 4 months later, he's dead all of a sudden. So look, I don't know what to do about all this. I don't know who to tell. I'm not sure. Certainly nothing could ever be proved, but I mean, but if you think about how they would do it, there could be an infinite number of ways that doctors could kill a patient that nobody would ever find out. But why they would do it is the part that I don't understand, unless it was just some kind of like new, bizarre, murderous protocol that the government of Australia or some faction therein wants to try to implement as a way of just culling out the old people in society, the sort of the eugenics movement, sort of soft eugenics, like sort of like they're not gonna take all the old people and burn them up in a oven and kill them in a gas chamber and then throw their ashes out on the ground. Much softer than that, they'll just like slip them some weird drugs in their food or something like that and just get them out of the way. Just because. I mean, I don't have any idea, but that's how we lost Rob this year. And so what I'm going to do, when I go back to Australia, probably in the beginning of March, I'm going to go to Tasmania and I'm going to make a very special pilgrimage and spiritual journey to Three Hammock Island, because I've never been there before. In fact, one of the things Rob and I talked about in our last meeting was that we were going to make a trip there when I came back together for the first time. So I'm going to go there in his honor and do some beautiful photography, maybe sit on the little bench where his mom sat and wrote her book, and see if I can commune with his spirit. And I've really been hoping and praying that Rob Alliston, having been such a good, beautiful person and so wonderfully supportive of me, that with the beneficence of all of our guardian angels and the Great Spirit, that he already has or will get to turn into a dolphin, at least for a while, and see what that's like. Anyway, the rest of this show will be some excerpts from the three radio interviews that I did with him, talking about his book, his love of the Indigenous people of Australia, environmental issues, things like that. Anyway, please send some prayers for Rob Alliston and the spirit of Tasmania. Tasmania is undergoing an extraordinary sequence of events right now. In less than 24 hours, a couple of days ago, over 2,000 dry lightning strikes hit and has ignited many, many, many dozens of fires. And if anybody thinks this is natural, they're fucking insane. This is not natural. Not natural at all. This is yet another whole story in itself. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio here in Christchurch, New Zealand. My next show is probably going to be an interview with Terry Lilly, my marine biologist friend in Kauai. And I've also got a show coming up with a brilliant flute player in America named Peter Phippen. Possibly an interview with Jill Stanley herself, before, after, and during the first cup of coffee. And we'll have to do an interview with Teddy, Wally, Ruby, and Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huckleberry, Snooch, Freddy, and Ellie, the new creature that's joined our family. Ellie's an elephant. She's got a very sad story to tell about all the elephants in Africa, along with the koalas and the Maui's dolphins and all of our family of life that's going extinct because of us, Homo sapiens, man the wise. All right, I'm signing out now. Listen to On the Brink Radio. Keep it in the road and live simply so that others may simply live. Good day. Welcome to On the Brink Radio with Jeff Weverson. This is show number 74 being recorded here in Sheffield, Tasmania. I'm with my old great friend Rob Alliston today, and he's having me. It's the first time we've been able to catch up since 2008. I've just come off of Flinders Island about 3 or 4 days ago. There's lots of birds in the background here. The setting sun's going down. But in this first interview with Rob, we're going to talk about his growing up on Three Hummock Island, which is in Bass Strait between Tasmania and Melbourne, and talk about the natural history of the islands and about the indigenous people of Tasmania and the islands in Australia. Rob, thank you so much for everything. It's great to see you.
Good to be here, Jeff.
Now, so we're in Sheffield, Tasmania now, where you've lived for a while, but you're from... Originally from, you were born in England, but basically grew up in Adelaide and in Tasmania, correct?
Yes.
And then your father, who was a naval officer, came upon, in his quest for a place for your family to move to down under, because he wanted to be near the 40th parallel, because, as I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, he believed that the Celtic origin people would do well in that kind of climate and stuff. So he found Three Hummock Island, and then you moved there and lived there for the first few years of your life. And so tell us about Three Hummock Island, where it is, how big it is, and a little bit about its natural history.
Okay, Jeff, yeah, well, it's quite a big island as islands go. It's about 55 k's around the outside. Outside, and there are rocky headlands and long beaches, and only in our time, only one family occupying that whole area.
Was that the Nichols family?
That's the Nichols family were before us. Yes. Yeah. So we went onto the island with the thought that we wanted to be there a long time, but only. The thing that really got in our way was that we were only managers there and not owners of the lease.
Yes, and you were. It was a lease from the Crown.
Was, yes.
And so you were able to have a long term lease though, right?
Yes, we got a 14-year lease actually. So it eventually came up for lease again when we were occupying the island, and we came so close to losing the island to another lessee that we made sure we improved the place enough to prevent other people coming in and bidding against us. We love the place so much by that stage.
Yes, and so how long was you and your family able to keep that lease for, or to basically stay there?
About 50 years.
Yes, yeah. That's like a generation and almost two generations.
It was, and of course, had to be educated, so we did correspondence school out of Sandy Bay in Hobart, and we spent a lot of time using the environment around our settlement for our own education.
Yes, as well as recreation.
Absolutely, yes.
And I love that photo you showed me yesterday of the, what do you call it, the Five Sisters, these really special boulders there.
Well, this is a good example of the granite rocks that underlie virtually the whole island.
And is this the same Devonian granite that you'd find on Flinders Island, Wilson's Promontory, and northeastern Tasmania?
Absolutely. It's Devonian granite, 350 million years old.
Very interesting. So your primary endeavor there in terms of sustenance and livelihood was growing cattle and sheep. Was that correct?
That's right, yes. That's what had been done there before and what we carried on with doing.
Yes. And so there's fresh water there, rivers, but any lakes or ponds?
Not much surface water, but a fair bit of water held behind the sand dunes. So water would come from the hinterland down towards the sea and get caught behind these sand dunes. And that meant that there were these long water courses which didn't flow much of the time, but were sort of static rivers, I call them.
Yes. Yes, so many rivers and streams in Australia are, when you look at them, they're actually just a bed of rocks. So they probably do flow with water at least a few times during the year. But, so let me ask you this. During your, especially early years growing up there, how often were you able or did you leave the island, and or how often did other people come out there to visit you for various reasons?
Okay, well, sometimes we'd be 6 months without any supply at all of food or mail or anything that comes from the outside world.
So this is truly, truly living off the grid.
It is, yes. We had a wind generator eventually, which is quite a small one, to provide us with power. But mostly it was little engines putting around the property that kept the place going.
Yes.
But my father was ex-Navy, and of course, and he was quite clever at finding innovative solutions to what was needed on the island.
Yes. What exactly did he do in the Navy? Was he an officer?
He was an officer, yes. He went through Dartmouth Naval College in England, and when he was 13, and eventually got up to the rank of commander in the Royal Navy, the English Navy. And then he was loaned to the Australian Navy to be a commander on that, or the skipper in charge of that vessel towards the end of the Second World War.
And which vessel was that?
It was called HMAS Warramunga. It was called a tribal class destroyer, which is a small warship that looks after bigger ships.
Yes, and what was your dad's name?
John. He was John Alliston.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, how about your, what was your mom's name? What's your mom's name?
That's Eleanor Young.
Yes. And a lot of people around Tasmania and even Australia would know her because of the book or books that she wrote about her life and experiences on Three Hummock.
They would. It's a great introduction for me. I can't go anywhere without some people saying, oh, we read that book 10 years ago, or we've been trying to get the book for years, or we read it when we were kids.
And what is the exact title of that?
It's called Escape to an Island.
Yes, and published in what year?
66, just as I was leaving school.
Okay, very interesting. So now back to a little more about the natural history of Three Hummock. You said that the highest point there is approximately 240 meters.
Yes.
And is there any sort of larger trees or forests there?
There was a huge forest in the middle of the island at one stage. It got burnt. It got burnt, however, because the fire that went through was very powerful, and not just a casual burn at all. And so we only ever had in our era, trees that were maybe 40 feet high.
Okay. Well, these are eucalyptus and she oaks.
Mostly eucalyptus, but a lot of heath country, banksias.
Yes. Do you have she oaks there?
We do, a small patch of she oaks, yes.
Okay.
Cajun, as we call it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So now, tell us about the wildlife there. There was wallabies, but no wombats.
That's right.
No, yeah. Platypus.
No, that's right.
But what about the birds? You said there was heaps of parrots there. Rosellas, green rosellas?
Yes, there were certainly mobs of them. They seemed to like being on the island. I know they were always, it was an island tribe of parrots, because they had their own language, we discovered. They made a different sound than the green rosellas on the Tasmanian coastline.
Yes.
That means they've been separated long enough to get some differences in their voice.
Yes, so you reckon that they stayed there rather than flying to Tasmania?
Yes. But on the other hand, there are quite a lot of birds that still follow their migratory paths from Victoria to Tasmania and
yes.
vice versa.
Well, I've noticed, like I was telling you, the rosellas have been my particular sort of spirit guide since I've returned to Australia from Hawaii the past few months, and I've really noticed that they've been every single place I've gone since the middle of March, with the exception of Neutral Bay, where there was lorikeets there, but every other place I've been, there's been rosellas of one or more type here, and I've become so familiar with their beautiful little song and their different sounds, and hearing the difference in their sounds and little the similarity, but the difference between their song and their little dialect of language and things like that. So, was there any cockatoos out there?
There were actually the black cockatoo was there, and occasionally you'd get a white cockatoo flying past. They would fly over that strait. And we also had the galah,
yes,
from time to time. But again, a migratory thing, not a permanent stayer.
Yep. And I believe you said you had three types of snakes: copperheads, tiger snakes, and what was the other one? A little whip snake.
White whip snake. Yes.
Yes. Very interesting. Now, what about your? Because you're right in the middle of the ocean at 40 degrees in the roaring 40s, what about your encounters with whales and dolphins and other cetaceans? And were you able to go out in boats very much while you were there?
Well, looking at the whales, first, most of the seals had been obliterated by sealing in the 1800s. And so they were just a memory. And they had abandoned some of the rocks that they used to sit on because they had bad rash memories for them.
But they still existed when you were there.
There were still a very small number of seals. Yes, a very small number. But occasionally we'd get to blackfish whales, as they're called.
Is that the orcas, the killer whales?
It's about 18 feet long and cool. Yes, I'm not sure what the other name for them is, but we call them blackfish whales, and they were actually hunted by Russian whale chasers in the Indian Ocean, and sometimes turned up at our beaches complete with harpoon and just floating in on the tide.
Oh my God! Do you have photos of that?
No, the actual harpoons in the Launceston Museum. I know that.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
So, but did you see dolphins or other whales that were alive and happy very much?
Oh, sure, yes. There were lots of dolphins there. And then they'd ride on the bow wave when we were children. We just got so used to seeing them there, and they seemed to be enjoying life so much.
Well, what did you think about them back then?
I guess we thought they were they represented a very intelligent presence. They seemed to know a lot about. They knew how to find the ship very fast if it was close by. Or they tended to be clever.
Yes. Did anyone regard them as like a threat or a competition for fishing or anything like that?
No, but that did apply to the vestigial remains of the seal colonies. So no fishermen ever attacked a dolphin, but they would attack the seals, because the seals got into their nets.
Yes.
And made a mess of their nets. So.
So while you were the caretakers there, fishermen could still come there? Seal hunters?
They tended... Well, no, these are fishermen who are trying to get rid of the small number of seals that are left.
But so they were able to come and do that while you were there?
Yes, because they do it out of sight of us.
Ah.
Imagine how much coastline was not visible to us at any one time.
Yes.
So they just come ashore. They'd never pitch a camp on the island. They'd just come in with their guns and shoot any seals they could and move on.
Just to kill them?
Just to kill them, to get them out of their nets. Yeah.
Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, archaeologically speaking, there's evidence of human habitation on, for example, Flinders Island and probably King Island and maybe other islands of the Furneaux group, and I believe Three Hummock, but I'm not sure, during the period of the last glaciation about 12,000-15,000 years ago, and then nothing in between until people were, the Tasmanian indigenous people were basically relocated or exiled to Flinders Island and Cape Barren in the 1800s. But what about the indigenous habitation on Three Hummock? And also, you said there's some really interesting rock art there that the indigenous people who did spend time there said that they themselves did not do.
Well, Jeff, the Northwest tribe used to come down to Wool North, or Cape Grim, as it's now called.
And what's the name of this tribe?
This is the Northwest tribe.
And do you remember their name?
I'm sorry, I can't pronounce it to you, but
we'll figure that out later.
Yeah. Anyway, they came down to the crossing between the Northwest Sea of Tasmania and Hunter Island, and they would swim out via those little islands, island hopping, and moving down the coast of Hunter in a northerly direction to the narrow crossing between Hunter and Three Hummock. And then they'd wait for the right tide and the right wind, and complete with their fire box that they'd take with them wherever they went. They would swim across to the nearest part of Three Hummock, roughly in September or thereabouts, and they would stay there until April before they would swim back in the other direction. They never wanted to live there. They were very happy to be itinerant.
Yes, but September to April, I mean, that's half a year.
It's a long time, yes.
And they went there mainly because of that. There was an especially abundant food supply during that time.
That's right. Yep. Yep.
And that was abalone and
mutton bird and crayfish.
Yes. Were they able to sort of store anything and bring it back with them, or they just sort of ate it all while they were there, sort of like in the way that like the whales feed heavily? They eat during the summer, then in the winter they may not eat very much.
Well, I think there was a bit of that in that the Aboriginal people would take back the increased
stored calories.
Stored calories, yeah, absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they felt good about that place, and they just wanted it to be like their summering place. They didn't want to live there.
Yes. Now, what was the situation with the indigenous people by the time that you went there as a child?
Well, they were mainly evidenced in the population of half, called half caste people that come to the island and do the mutton birding.
Yes.
Which meant putting their arm down in these holes and pulling out these baby chicks, which were hugely fat by that stage, and they needed the fat to survive while the parents were out and about. So there was a lot of growing of the mutton bird in the holes before they flew off.
And so when these half-caste indigenous people would come to do the mutton birding, were you telling me before that it wasn't just for their own sustenance, but that they harvested massive amounts so that they could sell it or export it?
That's right. That's the modern way they do it. They get permits to sell, and these there are areas around like Trefoil Island which are reserves for mutton birds, so they're treated like an indigenous food supply.
Yeah,
but also sold to anyone else that wanted to buy them.
Yes, so the mutton birds population's not endangered or threatened by this practice.
It's not. There are quite enough natural causes of difficulty when the birds are coming back from their migratory path, which goes basically right round the Pacific Rim. They often get bad storms, and we think also lack of food, because the krill is being eaten by other endangered species like whales and that sort of thing. So there are problems associated with coming back. Doing that long flight, it means they get very
depleted.
Yeah, and you see sometimes you see bunches of them along the tide line, having not quite made it.
Yes. So now, what about the rock art that you said exists on Three Hummock?
Well, this is very interesting, because it's quite clear that this is a special type of rock carving that's been done over quite a period of time, because it's actually etched in granite. And there's no other place in the whole Bass Strait area that has anything that looks like this rock art. It's really quite unique. And the situation where it is very benign, like there's a stream flowing down to the sea, and there's a shelter under the rocks, and you can just imagine the Aboriginal people sitting there doing their rock carving. The only interesting thing is that, well, one of several interesting things are true, and that is when the Tasmanian Aboriginal people, the modern ones, came back to Three Hummock, had a look at these carvings, they said, no, it's not us, it's some other tribe or some other people. It's very interesting, because we didn't, of course, know of any other group of people that would do that.
Did you say that some of them were like circular?
The migratory paths?
No, the rock art designs.
Oh, that's right, yes, they are. Yes. There's one there that looks absolutely like a crayfish.
Yes, yes, that's what you're saying.
There's a number of circular ones that 2 foot, 30 centimetres wide, I'd say, probably. And they go in about 10 centimetres.
Yes, I'd like to see your photographs of that. My friend Robert Bednarek, the rock art researcher, told me just a small number of years ago that Bob Brown had flown him down here to go and inspect a new rock art site that they discovered on the southwest coast. I'm wondering if that could be the same people that did this.
It's possible.
Very interesting. Has that? Do you know of any attempts to date the age of these glyphs that you're talking about?
There's no real. There is actually some work that's been done on Hunter, the next door island, by a woman from the ANU who is doing her PhD on Hunter and its people. And she did these horizon holes where she dug down and found what was further down in the sand and the rocks there. Yeah, so yes, that was one way. Logically, they were probably quite happy to walk across Bass Strait when there was no water there.
So now tell us about that. The belief is that they call it the land bridge that would have connected Wilson's Promontory south of Melbourne with the mainland of Tasmania and the what we call Flinders Island now and the rest of the Furneaux group would have been the higher elevations on this land bridge. And would the same thing apply to Three Hummock and King Island and the Hunter group up there?
Well, there are no... Yes, so the Flinders hasn't had any people on it, according to archaeologists, for around about 15,000 years. And we presume that I think it's been pretty well proven that the last bit of the land bridge to go down was the Flinders Island end, with those islands dotted between Flinders and Wilson's Prom. But the King Island side probably went down a bit before that.
Okay.
So there's probably been a land bridge, been no land bridge for around about 10,000 years.
And how long, roughly, how long would it have been continuous enough that people could transport themselves by land all the way from, like, what we now call mainland Australia down to Tasmania? A couple of thousand years, maybe?
I think they could see it coming. They had a sort of an idea that the sea was coming up every 100 years or so. There'd be another...
Yeah, there'd be smaller cycles within that. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. You said you have a map that you can show me of the land bridge.
Yes, I do.
That would be very interesting. Can you think of any other really important salient aspects to your life on Three Hummock Island that we should bring into the picture now about back then or about... So what exactly... Tell us about what's happening with Three Hummock Island now. Since your family gave up the lease there, how long ago?
Around about 2006.
Okay. Just the year before you and I met.
Yes.
In person. So what's happening? Well, let me ask you this. You were doing sort of would you call it a sort of eco-tourism thing out there?
I was, yes.
Where people would come out and... tell us about what you were doing.
Well, I was looking after my mother, who had become ill, so I was on the island looking after her. And I was looking around for some interesting diversions from the process of looking after my dear mother. And that turned out to be, the best proposition turned out to be a tourism venture run on light planes and boats and good walking trips, that sort of thing, and it didn't require much capital. It was very interesting to the people who went there. They felt very strongly affected. There was hardly a person that went to the island that wasn't affected emotionally by the vibes of the place, and that meant that the little business that I had grew pretty fast, and by its peak, probably in about 2000. I had probably about 150, 200 people there for weekends.
You'd have that many there at the same time?
No, this is over the time.
I see, yeah.
There'd be groups of 10 or 12 would come in on the small planes, and we would feed them lovely Tassie food, I would tell them the legends about the island and get them to the places that they were interested in, which was quite a few interesting geological places, and of course the rock art was very popular.
Yes, and what were some of those? Just quickly tell us some of those geological places.
Well, there are places that you could see were old upthrusts of the earth's crust there, especially on the South Hummock. There are lots of the island was virtually sitting on a boulder field, and this was it was all granite, and it was very high crystal, and it was just one of the rare to have such a big body of granite all in one place, because it actually upwells from under the Earth's crust.
Yes.
Through the Earth's crust.
And like I was telling you about that mountain in Fiordland, where Elizabeth and I had just come down from when the Christchurch quake happened, that we learned that granite is the most diamagnetic of all the minerals. That is, it does not conduct electricity at all, and it shields you from magnetic fields.
Is it? It's also got a lot of uranium in it, which is interesting.
Very interesting. And so, and I'll ask you, now, you said that you told the visitors there about some of the legends of Three Hummock. Well, what would, in a nutshell, is it some stories you would tell, or?
Yes, that's right. So quite a few stories I had.
I might get you to tell some of those later.
Well, example of one was, we had this is about 1823 when no one was living on the island at that point. And this ship came through from India with passengers, convicts, rum in big demijohns, and he got forced by weather into the group of islands which has Three Hummock in it. And they blew up on the beach below the house. This is quite large, square-rigged ship. And the skipper took a group of sailors into Tasmania and rowed down as far as the top end of the Tamar, bought special booked a salvage ship, and came back and took all the cargo back to Launceston. And then the skipper, whose name was Peter Dillon, went north to get another job in Sydney, and he got to be skipper of a ship that was running out to the island, a place called Vanikoro, and he came across the two French ships, the Boussole Boussole and Astrolabe, and they'd run into a reef up there, and the French government didn't know where they'd gone. They never appeared. They just disappeared. And when Dillon reported this to the French authorities, he was made a count, and had an income for life from that. So he was a very interesting buccaneer of a fellow.
Okay.
Good story.
Very interesting. So then you would continue doing the ecotourism thing with people out to Three Hummock Island.
Yes.
And then you stopped doing that when?
Well, I stopped doing it in roughly 2003, probably. By that stage, I was developing the early signs of Parkinson's disease, and I knew that, well, it was just impossible. I couldn't do any physical work, hardly at all, and I knew that I had to leave this most beautiful home on the island. Just the presence of the island was sustaining in itself. But I knew I had to go and find out what the best avenue was to lessen the effects of the Parkinson's that I had.
And so, was that how was your mom at that time?
Well, she was getting more and more frail, of course, and eventually went to Victoria to be near my sister, and she eventually died at 94. We kept her on the island as long as we could, because it was her sole place.
Yes.
As well.
And so when you had to leave the island because for medical reasons, is that when you transferred over the lease to the people that have it now?
That's right, yes. 2006, I think the new lease was signed.
Yeah.